Father in heaven, we thank you for this opportunity to be here this afternoon. Pray that you would bless us and guide us through this study, and that we would have a clearer picture of where we are on the prophetic timeline of Earth's history. Thank you for your blessings to us, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. So I'm just going to have one little slide here, which it's a picture of my book, which we will have available this evening after the second presentation. But it's a verse-by-verse commentary of the book of Daniel with practical applications as well. So it's Daniel, Practical Living in the Judgment Hour. And a lot of what we talk about this afternoon is found in that book as well. So I'm going to start off by asking a question. How many of you have spent any time studying Daniel chapter 11? A couple of people, a few people. It's a very fascinating chapter, and it's connected really to the rest of the book. Now, if you look at the prophecy of Daniel 11, there's actually a lead-in or an introduction in Daniel chapter 10. So you have an introduction to the vision of Daniel 2, for example. You also have that here in Daniel chapter 11. And that introduction is found in Daniel chapter 10. It's interesting, you know, when you study the prophecies, the four major visions, Daniel 2, it starts off with Nebuchadnezzar having a dream, and then Daniel is then given the same dream and interprets it for the king. Daniel 7, Daniel just has a vision right away. Daniel 8, again, he has a vision, and there is an explanation that follows. But Daniel 9 is further explanation for the vision of the 2300 days in Daniel chapter 8. We're going to get that in our Sabbath school lesson in the next few weeks here. And Daniel chapter 8, what you see is that Daniel is astonished at the vision. He doesn't understand it. And Daniel 9 helps him to understand the first portion of the 2300-day prophecy. He understood that it was for a long time because he was told in Daniel chapter 8, the question is, how long shall be the vision? And the vision that he saw was a ram, a he-goat, and a little horn. And he was told that the ram represented Medo-Persia and the he-goat represented Greece. So he knew this wasn't going to be for a few years. He was smart enough to realize that. He also saw the little horn power that persecuted God's people. So he knew that the 2300 days was over a period of 2300 years, but he didn't understand how that could be. Daniel 9 helps him to understand the beginning portion of the 2300-day prophecy, and it helps him to understand that the Messiah is in fact coming. In fact, Daniel had the honor of being the prophet that was given the timeline for the coming of the Messiah. That's a high honor. And so he comes to the end of Daniel 9, and he at least understands that the Jews aren't going to stay in Babylon forever. And a time is coming when the Messiah will come with a decree to restore and build Jerusalem. So that's something that we commonly understand from the book of Daniel. I think that's something that all of you would understand about the book of Daniel. Well, Daniel chapter 10, we pick it up, and it's in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So now we've transitioned into the Medo-Persian Empire. And it says, a thing was revealed unto Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar, and the thing was true, but the time appointed was long, and he understood the thing, and he had understanding of the vision. Here's what I would suggest to you today about the significance of Daniel chapter 11. Daniel 9 gives us further information so that Daniel understands, and it helps us as students of prophecy to understand what happens at the beginning of the 2300-day prophecy. There's a decree to restore and build Jerusalem. We understand from Ezra 7 that begins in 457 BC. So we have an understanding of the beginning of the prophecy of the 2300 days. Daniel 10, 11, and 12 gives us further help and guidance, because it helps us to understand what happens at the end of the 2300-day prophecy. At the end of Daniel 8, Daniel doesn't understand. All he knows is that it's going to be for a long time. He's astonished, and he faints. Daniel 9, now he understands, okay, the Messiah is coming. There's going to be a decree to restore and build Jerusalem. The Messiah is coming. And that is crucially important, because in order for salvation to take place, in order for the end of the 2300 days to matter, the Messiah has to come. And so Daniel gets that answer in chapter 9. But here's the amazing thing. The 2300-day prophecy, yes, it deals with the coming of the Messiah, and Daniel 9 gives us that information. But the end of the 2300-day prophecy points us to 1844 and to the rise of the Second Advent movement, just before Jesus comes back the second time. So within the 2300-day prophecy, we have the 490 years that are cut off that points us to the first advent, and then we have the remaining portion of that prophecy which takes us to the end of the world and effectively points us to the time of the second advent. That's why the 2300-day prophecy is such a significant prophecy. You know, people say, oh, I'm so tired of studying about beasts and horns and prophecies. Let's just talk about Jesus. And my response is, hang on. Do you realize that the 2300-day prophecy points us to the first advent of Jesus and the second advent of Jesus? Isn't that kind of important? And so when you put that together, you see that these prophecies are there for a reason, and they point us to the coming of Christ. The first time, they point us to the coming of Christ the second time. And Daniel understood that. And so here in Daniel 10, he has an understanding that it's going to be for a long time. And then we see kind of a picture of the great controversy here, because in verse 2, Daniel says, in those days I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant bread, neither came flesh nor wine in my mouth, neither did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. Well, what's happening here? Well, if you peel back the curtain, if you study history, we understand that there were 3 decrees that helped to restore and build Jerusalem, and they're in the book of Ezra. There was a decree of Cyrus, Darius, and then Artaxerxes. And those 3 decrees built upon each other, and Artaxerxes finally gave the decree that restored the Jewish people to following the law of God. But Daniel understood that the decree of Cyrus was of great significance, and during this time, the Samaritans, who hated the Jews, sent an evil report to Cyrus saying that the Jews were trying to raise up an insurrection and to set up their own government and kingdom in opposition to the king, and that they were taking advantage of the decree that he had given for them to go back to Jerusalem. And so Cyrus was considering, and he was weighing whether or not he would bring the Jews back and reverse the decree that he had given. And so Daniel understood the great controversy significance of this, because he understood that the timing of the coming of the Messiah and of the second advent and the cleansing of the sanctuary were all connected to this work going forward. And so during this time, he fasts, mourns, and prays for 3 full weeks. Why did he fast, mourn, and pray for 3 full weeks? Because in Daniel 9, he prayed. He comes to the Lord and he says, I've been studying from the book of Jeremiah that it's going to be 70 years that we're going to be in Babylon. So what's this thing about 2300 years? And I'm not understanding what's going on. And almost immediately the answer comes from Gabriel. But in Daniel 10, he prays for 3 weeks and no answer is coming, seemingly. But when you go to Daniel chapter 10, verse 13, it says, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me how many days? 21 days. How many weeks is that? 3 weeks. Now this is Gabriel speaking to Daniel here. Well, here's what happens. Daniel prays for 3 full weeks, and he's praying for all he's worth that Cyrus's mind will not be turned against the Jews. And Gabriel says that the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. What we understand is that Satan was working on the mind of Cyrus from the other side for 3 full weeks, and Gabriel was there working on Cyrus's mind. But then it says, but lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. Now, who's Michael? That's Jesus. So when Jesus came, all of a sudden, the issue is settled. And in if you go back to Daniel 10, verse 4, it says, after he prayed 3 weeks, it says, on the 420th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel, this is the Tigris River, the Euli is the Euphrates River, then I lifted up mine eyes, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz. His body also was like beryl, his face is the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire. Who's that? This is Jesus. He appears to Daniel, and then in verse 7, Daniel sees this great vision, and Daniel, he sees this vision, and he's so astonished by what he sees, he loses all of his strength, and he's on the ground, and then Christ or Michael sends Gabriel to wake Daniel up, and he says, hey, from the very beginning, I was coming to help you understand what would happen at the end, but I was held up for 21 days, by the prince of the kingdom of Persia. So Cyrus was undecided for 21 days what he was going to do. And the reason why he was undecided is because Gabriel and Lucifer were working for all they were worth on the mind of Cyrus. And Gabriel's trying to get Cyrus to side on the side of God's people. Lucifer's trying to get him to side against them. Because they understand if Cyrus goes against the Jews, the prophecy of the 2300 days and of the 70 weeks will be delayed. So it's a big deal. And Daniel understands that, and he doesn't necessarily know that Cyrus is having a contention where Lucifer and Gabriel are there, and Cyrus doesn't even realize that. But Daniel is a spiritual man, and he prays for 21 days until an answer comes. And this is a practical point. Daniel 9, he prays, and in a few minutes the answer comes, and sometimes that happens. Sometimes God gives us an immediate response to our prayer, and we come to church and we give a testimony of how God heard our prayer almost immediately as soon as we started praying. But sometimes it takes weeks, and sometimes it might be months or years. But in both cases, God was faithful, and Daniel prayed as long as it took. And then Gabriel tells Daniel what he's going to let him understand. He says, now I am come to make you understand what shall befall your people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. So if you, and this basically gives us a template to follow for the rest of the prophecy of Daniel 11. The primary subject of Daniel 11 is God's people, starting off with the Jews, and then the Christian church, and then finally God's remnant people. That is the subject matter, and it so happens that God's people get caught in the middle between the king of the north and the king of the south, who are mentioned at great lengths in the prophecy of Daniel 11. So then you go through the rest of Daniel 10, and Gabriel convinces Daniel that he will strengthen him to hear in verbal form the meaning of what he saw in the vision. So here's the interesting thing. Daniel prays for 3 full weeks. And he's praying, and he's praying, and he's praying, and he's saying, God, please deliver your people. Your honor is at stake. This prophecy and the timing of the coming of the Messiah is at stake. Please deliver your people. And after 21 days, Christ, who is Michael, looks down from heaven and says, Daniel's done it again. We don't need to make him wait any longer. And so he comes down from heaven, he turns the mind of Cyrus, and while he's there, he then reveals himself to Daniel, and he gives Daniel a vision, which was astonishing to Daniel what he saw. His strength was taken away from him, and he sees this great vision, and then Gabriel is sent by Michael to reveal to him what this great vision meant. And Daniel 11 gives us a lot more detail than Daniel 2, 7, or 8. And basically, if you understand the principle of repeat and enlarge, Daniel 2 is pretty basic. You have an image with metals. Daniel 7 is a little bit more extensive or detailed with beasts or animals. Daniel 8, you have sanctuary language with a ram and a he-goat. And then Daniel 11, you have literal kings, king of the north, king of the south. So, I'm going to have you look at this slide here. Now, let me see how this looks on the screen. I mean, I don't know how well you can see that picture, but I'll just I'll just explain it, even if you can't read the writing that well. But basically, this is a slide of the four major visions. And if you don't get anything else from the presentation today, if you understand this slide, you will get the main point of what I'm trying to share with you today, and that is this. The four major visions are connected to each other. They are related. They're not isolated. Yes, different languages used, but they have basically the same pattern. And when you look at the pattern, what you see is that there are the kingdoms of this world followed by apocalyptic events at the end. And so in Daniel 2, we have Babylon followed by Medo-Persia, then Greece, then Rome, then the divided kingdom with papal Rome. And at the end of that, a stone strikes the image and fills the whole earth. That's the second coming of Christ. That's the apocalyptic event. In Daniel chapter 7, now we have the animals, and we have, again, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. We have the dreadful beast with teeth of iron that represents pagan Rome. We have the little horn that comes up among the ten horns. That was in today's Sabbath school lesson, so we'll at least cover some of that since we missed it for Sabbath school. But the little horn comes up among the ten horns of Europe, of Western Europe. So we understand that the little horn has to be coming up in Western Europe because it comes up among the ten horns that represent the nations of Western Europe, and three of those horns are plucked up by the roots. But then after all of that, and after we see what the little horn does, we see that there is a judgment that begins in heaven. Then in Daniel 8, Babylon is missing, and the first kingdom that is mentioned is a ram, and we know that it's Medo-Persia because verse 3 says there's a ram, verse 20 says that the ram represents Medo-Persia, so we're not guessing. Babylon is missing, and we have Medo-Persia followed by Greece, and then there's a little horn, and it has two phases, the phase of pagan Rome, the phase of papal Rome, followed by the cleansing of the sanctuary. So the apocalyptic event in Daniel 2 is the second coming. The apocalyptic event in Daniel 7 is the beginning of the judgment. The apocalyptic event in Daniel 8 is the cleansing of the sanctuary. And in Daniel 11, we start off with Darius the Mede and the Persian kings, and we have the king of the north and the king of the south, the divisions of Greece. We have eventually pagan Rome becoming king of the north, then papal Rome becoming the king of the north. And at the end of all of that, Michael stands up, which is Christ, and that's the close of probation. Now, there's a couple of things, though, I want you to think about when you look at this pattern. The first thing that is of interest, we understand that the cleansing of the sanctuary and the beginning of the judgment begins in 1844 based on the 2300-day prophecy. So the middle two prophecies, Daniel 7 and 8, the apocalyptic event begins in 1844. The first vision and the last vision, the apocalyptic event is yet future. It's the second coming in Daniel 2. It's the close of probation in Daniel 11 and 12, which is just before the coming of Jesus. So here's the amazing thing. The book of Daniel as a whole is helping us to understand that the most significant time in Earth's history is from 1844 till the second coming. And that's the time we were alive in. Isn't that amazing? Of all the centuries we could have been born, we are the people who are alive at the most important time prophetically according to the book of Daniel. So Daniel is an absolutely fascinating book. Now I go through this more in the book, but this gives you an idea of the big picture. There's a couple of other things that are worth mentioning because there are three different main interpretations on Daniel 11 circulating in the church right now. Now, there's some other minor views that are out there, but there's three primary views that are being presented right now. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the other views. I'm going to present my position. But I would say this. The other two views make the Middle East and Islam. One's more of a Middle Eastern idea in Turkey. The other is more of Islam as a religion. They make that as a big issue at the end of Daniel 11. My response to that is, let's look at the pattern here. Daniel 2 shows us that Jesus is coming again. Daniel 7 then says, yes, Jesus is coming again, but in order for him to come back, there must be a judgment in heaven first. And then Daniel 8 says, in order for the judgment in heaven to be finished, the sanctuary in heaven must be cleansed. And then when you get to Daniel chapter 11, the end of the chapter, which is showing what happens to God's people in the latter days, what that is saying is that when the sanctuary in heaven is cleansed, Michael will stand up, probation will close, and Jesus will come back. Now, that puts the book of Daniel all together. Does that make sense? So Daniel 2, Jesus is coming again. Daniel 7, in order for Jesus to come back, there must be a judgment in heaven first. Daniel 8, in order for the judgment in heaven to be finished, there must be a cleansing of the sanctuary. Daniel 11, when the sanctuary in heaven is cleansed, Michael stands up, probation closes, Jesus comes back. And the book of Daniel itself means God is my judge. You see the element of judgment in those apocalyptic events at the end. And so when I get to Daniel 11, and I study that chapter, when I get to the end of that chapter, what I see is not a Middle East conflict, but rather the struggle that God's people go through as the papacy makes one final push against them through a Sunday law, which becomes a demonstration that they are on the Lord's side because they aren't following man's laws, they are following God's laws, which is an evidence that their life has been cleansed of sin. And when that evidence is demonstrated, Michael stands up and probation closes. One other thing that's interesting, before we get into some of the big picture ideas of the prophecy of Daniel 11, the name Michael is used to describe Christ four times in the Bible. Revelation chapter 12, the book of Jude, verse 9, and then we see it in Daniel 10 and in Daniel 12. And chronologically speaking, well, before I say that, Michael is used to describe Christ in great controversy warfare with Satan. And in Revelation chapter 12, this is the first time chronologically in the history of the universe, it's when there is war in heaven, Michael and his angels fought against the dragon and his angels, and the dragon prevailed not, he was cast out. So Michael wins. Then in Jude verse 9, it says Michael is contending with the devil over the body of Moses. The devil is saying, you can't raise him up. I got him to sin. He struck the rock in anger. He belongs to me. And Michael rebukes him. Moses is resurrected, and he goes to heaven with Christ. And we know that he was resurrected because he came down with Elijah just before Jesus died. So again, Michael wins. Then in Daniel 10, we see Michael show up when there's this contention over what's going to happen to the Jews, because the great controversy is at stake over the timing of the coming of the Messiah and of the cleansing of the sanctuary. Michael shows up after the faithful prayers of Daniel for 3 weeks, and again, Michael wins. And we're going to see when we get to the end of the presentation today, you're going to want to hear this. There's a reason why Christ is described as Michael at the end of the prophecy of Daniel 11 going into chapter 12, because it represents the final victory in the great controversy between Christ and Satan. And we're going to see why it's the final victory. So that's the big picture overview. And if you understand that, even if you don't understand every last little detail of Daniel 11 beyond that, if you understand that aspect of the big picture of the book of Daniel, you've got the main point of the book of Daniel. And everything starts to fall into place. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the first 30 verses other than to say there was a division of, well, we start off with Darius the Mede, then the Persian kings, and then Alexander the Great. That's seen in Daniel 7 and 8 also. And then after Alexander dies, there's the division of Greece into the four divisions. You can see that on this picture. But eventually Seleucus conquers Lysimachus and Cassander. He becomes the king of the north, and Ptolemy down in Egypt becomes the king of the south. And God's people, you see that yellow star there on the chart there on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. That is the territory of God's people, of the glorious land. They get caught in the middle between the king of the north and the king of the south. So when Gabriel says, now I'm come to show you what will befall your people in the latter days, we see that happening. So then in the next verses, there's many battles between the king of the north and the king of the south. Eventually, Pompey of Rome becomes the king of the north, and he enters into the glorious land in 63 BC. You see the death of Julius Caesar you see Caesar Augustus, the raiser of taxes. I'm not intending to do a history lesson here today. This is just showing you the detail of the prophecy. We see the death of Tiberius Caesar. In verse 23, we jump back in time. It talks about the league made with him. Some people will question why you jump back a little bit in time. It's because this is with respect to God's people. And they made a league with the Jews. The Jews made a league, with the Romans in 161 BC. This then leads into a description of verses 25 to 28. Of the final struggle of the literal king of the north and the literal king of the south in ancient times, when Caesar Augustus had a battle between Mark Antony and Cleopatra. Just a little bit of history here. Mark Antony and Caesar Augustus formed a triumvirate with one other individual to avenge the death of Julius Caesar. And Mark Antony even married Caesar Augustus's sister Octavius. But when he went down to Egypt on king's business, he met Cleopatra, and things happened. He married her, and he became the king of the south. This led to this battle, which was a struggle for the whole world, on September 2, 31 BC. And in this battle, Caesar Augustus trounced Mark Antony and Cleopatra. Mark Antony and Cleopatra had a larger army, but Caesar Augustus had a better trained army. And as soon as the battle started, Cleopatra got scared. She turns around in her ship. Antony follows after her. His soldiers are like, "This is who we're fighting for." Many of them declared for Caesar. Antony killed himself. Cleopatra was captured, but she allowed herself to be bitten by a snake rather than to be paraded through the city of Rome as a trophy, and she died. And that was all mentioned in Daniel 11:25 to 28. Then we don't hear anything else about the king of the south literally, which was literal Egypt in the first 30 verses. The king of the south is not mentioned again until Daniel chapter 11, verse 40. And there's a transition from pagan to papal Rome in verse 31. Now, Ellen White says a few things about Daniel 11. So again, I don't want you to get too lost in the weeds here. Keeping our eye on the big picture, what I just described to you was more specific detail of the history of the kingdoms that you see in Daniel 2, 7, and 8. Babylon, Medo, Persia, Greece, Rome. Babylon's missing from Daniel 11 just as it is in Daniel 8. So we see more specific detail of Medo, Persia, Greece, pagan Rome in the first 30 verses. And then we see a lot more detail of papal Rome from verses 31 to 45. That's basically what we're looking at. So now let's just look at some big picture ideas that Ellen White mentions. This is Testimonies to Ministers, pages 112 and 113. The light that Daniel received from God was given especially for the last days. The visions he saw by the banks of the Ulai and Hiddekel, the great rivers of Shinar, are now in process of fulfillment, and all the events foretold will soon come to pass. So Ulai is Euphrates, Hiddekel is Tigris. And Ulai was Daniel 8, Hiddekel was Daniel 10 and 11. Testimonies, volume 9, page 14, the world is stirred with the spirit of war. The prophecy of the 11th chapter of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment. Soon the scenes of trouble spoken of in the prophecies will take place. So that's very interesting. She says the prophecy of the 11th of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment. I find that fascinating because I want to know where we are and what is yet to be fulfilled. Then she makes this similar statement, which gives us a clearer picture of what's happening. This is Manuscript Releases, volume 13, page 394, where she says, "We have no time to lose. Trouble as times are before us. The world is stirred with the spirit of war. Soon the scenes of trouble spoken of in the prophecies will take place. The prophecy in the 11th of Daniel has nearly reached its complete fulfillment. Much of the history that has taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated." Then she says, in the 30th verse, "A power is spoken of that shall be grieved in return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So he shall do, or so shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant." Now this power that is spoken of in the 30th verse is the papacy. And just as we transition from pagan to papal Rome in Daniel 7 and 8, we see that clearly. We see it again in Daniel 11. Now, she continues to quote Daniel 11 all the way through verse 36 after starting in verse 30. And if you look at those verses, basically you see the rise of a power that will have military strength on its side. It will place the abomination that makes it desolate, and then it will persecute God's people for many days. That's the gist of those verses. Then Ellen White goes on to say, because she says, much of the history that has taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated, so I want to know which history is going to be repeated. Well, I would assume it's verses 30 to 36, and she confirms that in the next sentence by saying, scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. So if you want to do a good study, and this is what we're going to look at here next, if we look at the history of 30 to 36, this gives us an idea of what we can expect from the portion of the prophecy that has yet to be fulfilled. Does that make sense? She says, much of the history that has taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated. Then she describes the history of the papacy during the Dark Ages. That's what's described in Daniel 11, 30 to 36. And then she says, scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. Now, we understand from Revelation chapter 13 that the papacy received a deadly wound in 1798, but eventually the deadly wound will be healed, and all the world will wonder after the beast. And so this is another way of saying, we see what the papacy was like until the deadly wound in Daniel 11, 30 to 36, and really to 39. Then it gets a deadly wound in verse 40, and then the deadly wound will be healed. And the way it prospered in Daniel 11, 30 to 36 is the way it will rule when the deadly wound is healed. Does that make sense? And again, I realize some of you may not have seen this prophecy before, but I'm trying to just give you some big picture ideas where we're not getting lost in the weeds of every last verse, but we're seeing the big picture of what Daniel 11 is talking about. So we're just going to look briefly at some of the key elements of Daniel 11, 30 to 36. So Daniel 11, 30 to 36, the papacy has intelligence with those who forsake the Holy Covenant, so they form a political alliance with the kings of the earth. In verse 31, we see the arm stands on their part. That's military power. This is Clovis of the Franks, who makes an agreement with papacy. Now remember, we talk about this in Daniel 7, where you see this little horn, it comes up among the ten horns, and three of the ten horns are plucked up by the roots, and we've understood that to be the Ostrogoths, the Vandals, and the Heruli. That's from Daniel 7. So again, this is looking at it from a different angle when it says, arms shall stand on his part. Well, the little horn came up in Western Europe, and three of the horns, or three of the nations of Western Europe, were utterly annihilated, but it wasn't through the Vatican Guard. It was through a military power that offered it assistance, and that was the military power of Clovis, king of the Franks. So the three horns that were plucked up by the roots didn't just magically disappear. No, there was a military power that assisted them in doing so. So that's something that we should expect to see again. Remember, she says scenes similar will take place, so we're going to see military superpowers assisting the papacy to accomplish the papacy's political and religious goals. Taking away the daily, I'm not going to say a whole lot about that, but the abomination of desolation is the union of church and state, which took place in 508, where Clovis unites his army with the papacy, and then in 538, the decree of Justinian that made the Roman bishop the head of all the churches. And that was a decree from a political power. So then there's the persecution of the saints, which lasts for many days. The persecution continued to the time of the end. Then we see the deadly wound. And again, Ellen White reminds us, much of the history that has taken place in fulfillment of this prophecy will be repeated. Scenes similar to those described in these words will take place. So what we can expect when the papacy's deadly wound is healed, a military power outside of the papacy will assist it to enforce its dogmas. This will then lead to the union of church and state, which will lead to the persecution of the saints before the papacy is utterly destroyed. And that's basically our understanding of what Revelation 13 describes anyway. When the papacy speaks as a dragon, and the second beast speaks as a dragon. So how does history repeat? You know, if you look at Daniel 11, the papacy had supreme power in verses 30 to 39, where it ruled Western Europe and really the main part of the world that was known at that time, all the way till 1798. However, in 1798, or shortly before 1798, Revelation chapter 11 describes a beast that comes up out of the bottomless pit. Now, just out of curiosity, what is that power? It's an end-time satanic power. When a beast comes up out of the abyss or out of the bottomless pit, that's describing a satanic power. What was the satanic power that came out of the abyss in Revelation 11? It was the French Revolution. I heard someone say that. And the French Revolution was driven by the principles of atheism. And by the way, just to make things relevant for the time we're living in, Ellen White says that the conditions that existed just before the French Revolution will take place before Jesus comes back. Now, I'm not making any predictions, but I don't also see it as a coincidence that one of the candidates running for president of the United States right now is pushing what he calls a revolution, which is largely based on the same principles as the French Revolution, which is basically socialism and atheism. Now, I'm not telling you who to vote for and who not to vote for. I'm just saying this is a matter of fact, that we are living in a time where America, which was based on the principles of religious liberty and Protestantism and republicanism, which was based on the principles economically of capitalism, is listening or giving an ear to potentially a candidate who could be, has a decent chance to become the nominee of the Democratic Party to run for president. Now, I'm not saying, I'll just say this. If we get to choose between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, I'm going to be like, you got to be kidding me. I'm trying not to be political, but I'm just saying, of all the millions of people in the United States, if those were our options, that just tells you where we are in Earth's history. And the point I'm trying to make is that atheism, which drives the principles of communism and socialism, was a satanic power as described in Scripture. So just think about that. And the French Revolution, I mean, they were burning Bibles in the street. They were worshiping the goddess of reason. And eventually it was the French Revolution that gave rise to the atheistic France. And it was then Napoleon who took Berthier, or he sent Berthier down to the Vatican to take the Pope captive. So interestingly, in Revelation chapter 11, the French Revolution and the beast that arises from this bottomless pit is described spiritually as Sodom and Egypt. So the licentiousness of Sodom and the atheism of Egypt, Ellen White actually says in Great Controversy 269, speaking of the atheism of Egypt being reborn in France, she refers to Pharaoh saying to Moses, "Who is Jehovah that I should obey him?" And she says that's atheism. And yes, the French worshipped the goddess of reason, but they were atheists. They did not worship the true God. And so it was this power that delivers a deadly wound to the papacy. We understand that from Revelation 13, that the deadly wound came from France taking the Pope captive. And that deadly wound is described in Daniel 11, verse 40, where it says, "And at the time of the end, shall the king of the south push at him," which is the king of the north, which is the papacy. That word "push" is the Hebrew word nagak, which means to gore, which means it's like a bull with a horn leading with that horn into its opponent with the intent to kill. So when it says at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, it's not describing an unfriendly push or shove. No, it's describing a goring, which is with the intent to kill. This is the deadly wound. And the reason why it was a deadly wound to the papacy is because up until 1798, the church had power over the state. And as long as the church had power over the state, that makes the papacy who it really is. That's the 1260 years. By the way, have you ever wondered why God allowed the papacy to rule for 1260 years? What was the purpose of that? Well, let me explain it to you briefly. The papacy represents Antichrist. The dragon gave his power, seat, and authority to the beast, which is the papacy. So you have Christ, you have Antichrist. The book of Revelation is the revelation of Jesus Christ. So by the way, if the only thing you know about the book of Revelation is Revelation 13 and the identity of Antichrist, you've missed the point of the book of Revelation. It's simply there to contrast the power of Antichrist to the power of Christ. But get this, Christ had a ministry that was for 3.5 literal years, which in the Jewish calendar was for 1260 literal days. And at the end of those 3.5 years, now by the way, I don't know if it was exactly 1260 literal days, but it was for 3.5 literal years, I'll say that much. And at the end of the 3.5 literal years, Christ died on the cross, meaning he had a deadly wound, but then after his death, he was resurrected, meaning the deadly wound was healed. And on the cross, as he is dying, he has demonstrated to the universe the principles of God's government so that there are no questions left to the onlooking universe about what God's government and character is truly like. But then Satan turned around and said, in the great controversy battle, you have to give me my chance. Now, it didn't take 3.5 literal years. It took 3.5 prophetic years, which is 1,260 years. And at the end of the 1,260 years, the papacy received a deadly wound. But just before the deadly wound took place, the principles of Satan's government were fully demonstrated through the French Revolution, where it says in Revelation 11, it says, where also our Lord was crucified, because when the French Revolution took place, it destroyed Christianity. And what happened in the French Revolution for the 3.5 literal years of the French Revolution, you had utter anarchy with the guillotines, and friends were turning in friends as they're trying to climb over each other to get to the top to be in charge, and you have utter anarchy and mayhem. And if you want to know what heaven would have become if Satan had defeated Christ in the struggle for power in heaven and for the power of the universe, all you have to look at is the French Revolution. And when the universe saw what happened in the French Revolution, God could look to them and say, do you have any further questions? After 3.5 prophetic years, the papacy has demonstrated, well, Satan has demonstrated through the papacy, which gave rise to the French Revolution, what the principles of his government are truly like. Because France was the one who started with Clovis of the Franks to exalt the papacy. France was the most supportive of the papacy throughout the 1260 years. You have the St. Bartholomew's Massacre. They drive the papacy, or they drive the Protestants out. But eventually, the people of France said, if this is what God is like, we want nothing to do with him. So they get rid of the Catholics and all of the Christians and say, we're going to worship the goddess of reason, and they turn into atheists, and the 3.5 years of atheism where this beast comes up out of the abyss or the bottomless pit is a demonstration of what heaven would have become like if Satan would have had the time to develop his government in heaven. But because he couldn't do it in heaven, he was given the opportunity on earth, and the French Revolution is the demonstration of that. And then you could have the deadly wound, and then God can say, okay, now do you see why there's the need for the judgment? Because you have the kingdoms of this earth, Babylon, Medo-Persia, pagan, and then papal Rome. And papal Rome is a synthesis of all of the kingdoms that came before it, which is why it's described as Babylon at the end, because the head of gold is Babylon, and as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. So the way Babylon thinks drives the rest of the kingdoms, and then Medo-Persia's laws couldn't be changed, so they're infallible. And then Greece brought about human reasoning, which says we're smarter than God. The papacy brought about persecution, or excuse me, the pagan Rome brought about persecution, and the papacy brings all of it together into a system at the end of time described as Babylon, which is Antichrist. And after 1,260 years of these kingdoms warring against Christ, God could say, now you see what Satan's government is all about. It's time to have a judgment. And then he says, I'm going to raise up a second Advent movement who will be a demonstration on this earth of what my government is like. You've seen it through Christ and his ministry and his 3.5 years and his death on the cross, but you will also see it through the second Advent movement at the end. And that's what Daniel 11 climaxes to. So let's just kind of go through some of this briefly. After the deadly wound, the atheistic principles continued on. In 1844, Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto from Paris, France, interestingly in the year 1844. That gave rise to the Russian Revolution of 1917 and then to the Cold War, where the Soviet Union was in the backyard of the papacy. So the King of the North makes a comeback, and he does so with a military power in verse 40, where he has chariots, horsemen, and many ships. So now we see history repeating itself. And we see the deadly wound in 1798. We've discussed that. So after the deadly wound, we see that a military power will give force to the papacy. Have we seen any nation form an alliance with the papacy since 1798 that leads to the weakening, maybe not the demise, but the weakening of the King of the South? And in Time magazine, February 24, 1992, it describes a meeting that took place between President Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II on June 7, 1982. And in that meeting, Protestant America meets with Catholic Western Europe and the leaders of those entities, so to speak. And the president offered the assistance financially, economically, and militarily of the United States to help bring down the communist Soviet Union, and they started by targeting Poland. This was one of the great secret alliances of all time. Some of you may remember Lech Walesa. He was the leader of the Solidarity movement in Poland. I was a kid when he was of fame, and he was part of that whole thing. And despite the fact that there are negative elements to this, it's a good thing that the Soviet Union fell, because it opened up the doors for God's people to go in as well. So it wasn't all bad. It's just that this was the way that the papacy started to make a comeback. Now, many of you probably remember one of the most iconic moments of Reagan's presidency when on June 12, 1987, about 5 years after that meeting with the Pope, he stands in front of the Brandenburg Gate of the Berlin Wall and says, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And within 2 years, the wall came tumbling down. And we're living a momentous time of Earth's history where we've, even many of us in this room, were alive when these things happened. And I believe this is some fulfillment of the prophecy of Daniel 11. And, you know, when the Pope died, we saw a current U.S. president at that time, George W. Bush, with his father, H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, along with the First Lady, and you can't see her in the picture, but the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, was there as well. And we see that now the United States of America, as has been predicted in the book of Revelation, has formed a very cozy relationship with the papacy. Now, I've read these statements before. Again, we see that the prophecy in the 11th chapter of Daniel, much of that history will be repeated the way the papacy was during the Dark Ages, will take place at the end of the world. So after you see a military power, the United States in this case, support the papacy, then you're going to see a church-state union. And so that's the next thing that we're waiting to take place. Now, I talked about that in the sermon this morning. We don't know when the Sunday Law is going to happen. I'm not here to make any predictions. These are event prophecies, not time prophecies. So we don't know when the next thing is going to happen, but this is described, the abomination of desolation is described in Daniel 11:41 when it describes the king of the north entering into the glorious land. Now, the glorious land was the territory of God's people, as described in Daniel 11:16. That was the territory of the literal Jews. But in the book, you know, some people, to this day, even in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, believe that the glorious land here in Daniel 11:41 is still literal Israel. Here's why I don't believe that. Because the very same book of Daniel, Daniel 9, gives probationary time for the Jewish nation, 70 weeks. And so Jesus dies in 31 A.D., and then 3.5 years later, Stephen is stoned. And just before he dies, he looks into the heaven. He says, I see the Son of Man. This is Acts 7:55. I see the Son of Man standing on the right hand of the throne of God. And that's not accidental language. Jesus stood up to indicate that probation had closed for the Jewish nation, just as Michael stands up when probation closes for humanity. So now individual Jews could still be saved, but the Jews as a nation, their probation had come to an end in 34 AD when Stephen was stoned, just on time with the 70-week prophecy. So after 34 AD, yes, Jews are part of God's people, but they are not the distinct, special, chosen people of God. It became the Christian church. So the territory of God's people after 34 AD was no longer literal Israel. It was the territory of God's people, and now we are a worldwide movement. So when the King of the North enters into the glorious land, he is targeting God's people. And when you study Daniel 11, when the King of the North or the King of the South entered into a territory, it wasn't to just say, hey, what's up? It was for the purpose of conquest. So when the King of the North enters into the glorious land in Daniel 11:41, this is going to take place at some point in the future. It is for the purpose of conquering the territory of God's people, and the way the papacy will attempt to conquer God's people is through a Sunday law, where they will be forced to choose between worshiping God, which keeps them as part of God's chosen people, or will they worship man, which would then cause them to receive the mark of the beast, where they are no longer God's people. That's the next thing that is going to happen in Daniel 11. So where I see us right now, I see us as being at a point where the next event in the prophecy of Daniel 11 is a Sunday law. Now, I'll mention this point as well. There's a glorious holy mountain mentioned in verse 45. The glorious land in the first part of the chapter described literal Israel. The glorious holy mountain is Mount Zion on the north side of Jerusalem. And there's a few verses that you can use to show that idea. But it's in Jerusalem. So the glorious holy mountain is a smaller territory. So you start off with a glorious land. You end up with a glorious holy mountain. Those who will survive the shaking. So what I believe, and I mean, I believe that the glorious holy mountain represents the worldwide Seventh-day Adventist Church, which includes the remnant church of Bible prophecy. And I want you to turn to Joel chapter 2, verse 32, just so that you can see this point. Joel chapter 2, verse 32. And by the way, Psalm 48, 1 and 2 says, great is the Lord, greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness, beautiful for situation. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the side of the north, the city of the great king. So it's the holy mountain on the side of the north. Daniel 9:16 identifies Jerusalem as the holy mountain, which is where Mount Zion was. In Joel 2:32, actually if you start in verse 31, you see end time language. The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, before the great and the terrible day of the Lord come. Those are signs of the end of the world. Verse 32, it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as the Lord hath said, and in the remnant whom the Lord shall call. Now it's interesting, that word delivered or deliverance is the same word as Daniel 12:1, where it says, at that time shall Michael stand up, and then at the end it says, at that time thy people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. So Michael stands up to deliver his people, and they are the ones found in Mount Zion. And in this verse, we see that Mount Zion, Jerusalem, and the remnant of God's people are used as a synonym of each other. So I believe that at the end of Daniel 11, Those who survive the shaking are the ones that are found in the glorious holy mountain. And they will stand on Mount Zion with the Lamb in Revelation 14. So I see the glorious land as representing spiritual Israel, including worldwide Adventism. It could also include people that are considered God's people of other faiths outside of the Catholic Church. Before the shaking, then the King of the North enters into the glorious land for the purpose of conquest. This is the National Sunday Law. This is the abomination of desolation. Now, here's a statement from Great Controversy, page 608. As the storm approaches, a large class who have professed faith in the third angel's message but have not been sanctified through obedience to the truth abandon their position and join the ranks of the opposition. By uniting with the world and partaking of its spirit, they have come to view matters in nearly the same light, and when the test is brought, they are prepared to choose the easy, popular side. Men of talent and pleasing address who once rejoiced in the truth employ their powers to deceive and mislead souls. So let me just say this. If you are not experiencing sanctification, you are being prepared to receive the mark of the beast. If the righteousness by faith that you believe in says you don't need sanctification in order to be saved, you are preparing to receive the mark of the beast. Because when the final test comes, those who don't have a sanctified walk will be overthrown. Now, when you look at Daniel 11 and really end time events, the Sunday law, it doesn't just all of a sudden happen, boom. If you don't go to church on Sunday, you're going to be put to death. No, there's a progression. And you can see the progression here on the screen. It starts where you're told to refrain from working on Sunday. And Ellen White actually tells us during this time we should do missionary labor to warn the world of what's happening. And we don't need to go in and work to antagonize the world. We can use it as a time to do missionary labor and witnessing. But as it progresses, they will say, not only do you refrain from working, you need to honor Sunday, but you can still worship on the Sabbath. Then it escalates to the point where it says you cannot worship on Sabbath, only on Sunday. You will be fined and imprisoned if you don't go along. And finally, there is a death penalty to those who worship the Sabbath and disregard Sunday. So those are the stages. Now, I'm just going to mention this briefly. Edom, Moab, and Ammon escape the hand of the papacy in Daniel 11:41. I believe this represents people of other faiths who come in under the loud cry message. I'm admittedly summarizing. You can get greater detail if you go back and study this further, if you get my book or listen to some of my other presentations online. Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia are then mentioned in verse 42. It says, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Now remember, Egypt represented the king of the south in the first 30 verses. This represents the king of the south. It represents atheism. Remember that we still have China, which is an atheistic nation. When the final crisis hits, remember Revelation 13 says that the false prophet, which is Protestant America, is going to make fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men to show that God is on the side of this false system of worship. And when atheists see miracles, for atheists, seeing is believing, atheism will cease to exist. So the king of the north is going to conquer all of its territory. It passes through the territory of the glorious land with a Sunday law, thinking it's conquered God's people, and then it thinks that it's conquering the atheists of this world. Libya and Ethiopia are mentioned in verse 43. They were the countries that were a last line of defense for Mark Antony and his battle against Caesar Augustus. I see them as ancillary powers that have been on the side of atheism against Western nations over the last 100 years, and that's typically been the Islamic nations of the Middle East who aligned themselves politically with the Soviet Union against the United States of America. So I don't see Islam as the king of the south, as some are saying, that are going to make a push against Christianity and that will lead to the end of the world. I see Islam as, yes, a part of end time events, but not a major player, and they will be overrun by this as well. And then it says that he will have power over the treasures of and of gold and of silver. That's the escalation of the Sunday law where you can't buy or sell. Now we're almost done here. We're down to verse 44. It says, but tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. These tidings out of the east and out of the north, when the papacy gets down to Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia, he's to the south and west of Israel, spiritually speaking. And in the mind of the Hebrew, that means he's conquered the whole world. All the world has wondered after the beast. But it's at that moment when the papacy thinks he has conquered the whole world that there will be a message. This is the loud cry message of Revelation 18, where the earth is illuminated with the glory of God's character, and it identifies the papacy as the hold of every foul spirit and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird, which will enrage the papacy. And this goes along with Revelation 12:17, where the dragon is wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. I find it interesting that at the very time God's people need to be holding on to Christ and to the law of God and to the testimony of Jesus, which is the spirit of prophecy, because our faithfulness to Christ through obedience, through his power, and our belief in the testimony of Jesus, which is the spirit of prophecy, which will guard us against the attacks of Satan, at that very time right now that we need those gifts to avoid the deceptions of Satan, many in the church are calling obedience legalism and the writings of Ellen White out of date and irrelevant to us as a people. Isn't that interesting that the devil has come into the church through the minds of some of us as a people so that we wouldn't even accept the gifts that are needed to withstand the last crisis of Earth's history? Don't give up those gifts, and don't be deceived. So these tidings identify Christ, and they identify Antichrist. The earth is illuminated with the glory of God's character, and the message is given with power that identifies the king of the north as the power of Satan. And so we've talked about the loud cry message already, so I'm going to skip over that. And so we see the persecution of the saints. As the loud cry message goes out, God's people will be persecuted, and a death decree is given, and persecution revives. And then we see in verse 45, he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. So here we see this death decree, where the papacy plants the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Now, King James Version says in the glorious holy mountain. New King James says between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. That does make more sense. So the sea represents the Mediterranean Sea. The glorious holy mountain represents Jerusalem. And so if you look on the map, there's this union of church and state that takes place between the Mediterranean Sea and between Jerusalem or the glorious holy mountain. Now, in Scripture, in Revelation 17, sea represents people. And then the glorious holy mountain represents Mount Zion, which represents the remnant, which represents the 144,000. So what's happening is here, you have a death decree, which is the final abomination of desolation, where the entire world, the sea of people, they are on the side of the papacy, and they are ready to wipe God's people off the map. And just as the city of Jerusalem was surrounded by the Roman army in 70 AD, now spiritual Jerusalem is being surrounded by spiritual Rome, and the whole world is on the side of spiritual Rome with a death decree. And it seems as if God's people will be wiped off the map, but then Daniel 12 verse 1 says, and at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people. And remember, when Michael stands up, probation is closed, the sanctuary has been cleansed. He's standing up for a victorious people who have gotten over the victory, have gained the victory over the beast and over his mark and over the number of his name, and they have received the seal of the living God. That's who Michael is standing up for here. And I want to read the statement from Review and Herald, November 19, 1908. Wonderful events are soon to open before the world. The end of all things is at hand. The time of trouble is about to come upon the people of God. Then it is that the decree will go forth, forbidding those who keep the Sabbath of the Lord to buy or sell, and threatening them with punishment and even death, and if they do not observe the first day of the week as the Sabbath. So again, there you see death decree, and then notice what Ellen White says. And at that time shall Michael stand up. So when there's a death decree, Michael stands up and probation closes. The great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Now remember, Gabriel said, I'm come to show you what will befall your people in the latter days, for yet the vision is for many days. When Michael stands up and it says your people shall be delivered, this is not describing the deliverance of the Jews. This is describing the deliverance of the remnant church, who are the people of God, and they are the people of Daniel, whose names are found written in the book. Now, in closing, I'm just going to share something that I find to be very fascinating. You know, we see that Michael stands up, and he's standing up from a seated position. If we understand what he was doing while seated, we will understand the work that has been completed. Well, we understand there's multiple places in Scripture that he is seated at the right hand of God. Hebrews 8 verses 1 and 2 says that he's seated at the right hand of God as our high priest. And in Hebrews 8 verse 6 it says, as our high priest, he's the mediator of a better covenant. And in Hebrews 8, verses 9 through 12, as the mediator of a better covenant, he is working to write his law into our hearts and minds. Now, when he finishes his work as our high priest of writing his law into our hearts and minds, which is a transcript of his character, it would be fair to say that he will have a commandment-keeping people. Not only that, Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 says he's the author and finisher of our faith, seated at the right hand of God. And in Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, as we look to the author and finisher of our faith, we are exhorted to run with patience or endurance the race that is set before us. We are told to exercise faith, the faith of Jesus. So when Christ finishes this work, he will have a group of people who have the patience of the saints and the faith of Jesus. So think about this. You've seen the verse in Revelation 14, 12, which says, here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Here's the amazing thing that's happening in Daniel 12, verse 1. Remember, when Michael shows up, it means that there is great controversy warfare. And the reason why Michael shows up in Daniel 12, verse 1 is because the devil, through the papacy, has enacted a death decree to wipe God's people off the map. But at that moment when the death decree is given, probation closes, because God has a people who have withstood the mark of the beast crisis. And so Michael can show up and he stands up to deliver his people, and he can look to the onlooking universe and say, here they are. No matter what you throw at them, here they are. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And the term Michael is used to describe Christ because he has now won the final victory in the great controversy between Christ and Satan. Because Satan has seen the great controversy flipped on its very head before his eyes when Christ shows up here. Because Satan was a perfect being in a perfect environment, and he says God's law cannot be kept. And yet, at the most trying time of Earth's history, those who live as the weakest humans from the most defective generation that has ever been will have had the character of Christ reproduced in their lives through the work of Christ, who has been seated at the right hand of the throne of God, and he can then stand up for our deliverance because his work in our lives will have been accomplished. That's amazing to me, and that will coincide with the cleansing of the sanctuary. So that basically summarizes the message of Daniel 11, and it summarizes the book of Daniel. Daniel 2, Jesus is coming again. Daniel 7, in order for Jesus to come back, there must be a judgment first. Daniel 8, in order for the judgment in heaven to finish, the sanctuary in heaven must be cleansed. Daniel 11 shows at the very end, when the papacy enters into the glorious land and passes a Sunday law for the purpose of conquering God's people so that they would go against the law of God, there will be a people on the earth who will be a demonstration of what it means to be faithful to God unto death. They overcome by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They love not their lives unto the death, and they are a demonstration of the character of Jesus. And Michael will then stand up and say, the sanctuary in heaven is cleansed, probation is closed, and I am coming back to deliver my saints whose names are found written in the book. So I don't know about you, friends. I think we would all say, when Michael stands up, I pray, and it's my desire that my name, that your name, will be found written in the book. And when that happens, our destiny will be sealed for eternity, and Christ will come to claim us as his own. Amen? So that's a good stopping point. We're going to have a 15-minute break before the last meeting. I just want to remind you that a lot of what I shared this afternoon is found in the book that will be available after our last meeting. And so let's just have a brief word of prayer, and we will close. So let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this time that we've had to reflect on this great prophecy of Scripture. May we be faithful. May you come soon. May we be found ready, and may our names be found written in the book when Michael stands up. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.